This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Kevin Cope, the LSU Faculty Senate President for the last several years and celebrating 31 years as an LSU professor. This man from Harvard by way of San Diego has chosen to live in our midst, and Kevin Cope usually has an opinion about something, no matter what the topic, and we'll talk with him about what's happening at LSU as faculty members have received another raise. LSU will be tobacco-free on August 1st. Will there be fights at football games? Will the LSU baseball team be prohibited from using tobacco products? Interesting times at the Old War School, independent of the budget crisis, which has slammed higher education for the last 6 years. All this with Kevin Cope, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757, wherever you are. And Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest is the lucid and loquacious Kevin Cope. He's been a fixture at Louisiana State University since August 18th, 1983, when he arrived. As Hurricane Alicia was pounding the Gulf Coast, Kevin Cope came this way, and he's been here for 31 years, despite the ups and downs that the Old War School has endured during the last three decades and change. Good morning, Kevin Cope.
Good morning, Jim. Always a pleasure to be here with the voice of educated engagement.
Well, I love you, too. And I'm certainly quite pleased that LSU employees are destined to receive another pay hike.
This is indeed a step forward. I wouldn't call it a major step forward, but when you're at the back of the pack, you're the 20th horse in the Derby, then perhaps a few steps forward is a good development. I think that the university has been so far behind in its pay scales for so long that the step forward seems like a gigantic one, and maybe it is because it shows a change in momentum. We're certainly grateful to the people at the top who have engineered this. There's still a long way to go, though, especially at other universities around Louisiana that contribute to the whole educational project.
Well, a 3% pay hike of merit pay on the heels of last year's 4% increase, and this is happening under the watch of the King, King Alexander. He is, it's always nice to preside when the cash is flowing to the people for whom work for the King.
That is so true. We look across history and we see people who have come along at the wrong time, presidents who have stepped in at the beginning of a depression. Well, King Alexander has once again drawn a favorable coin in the lottery of life. But I think, of course, this would have been inevitable as well. No place stays in a recession or a depression forever. And the truth of the matter is, we've got plenty of money in Louisiana. We just have bad tax policies and a bad distribution of wealth.
Well, the King has been on the job, F. King Alexander, for 1 year, and has received nice plaudits for his work. Are you getting along well with him?
So far, so good. In fact, I will confess here in front of the public microphone that I've been pleasantly surprised. We have had any number of conversations and have moved a number of issues forward. Of course, we have to keep in mind that in all political arrangements, there is a variety of interests. That is, F. King Alexander serves the need of the institution as a whole and also the needs of the state of Louisiana. I, on the other hand, fancy that I serve the faculty and the needs of those who want to be educated. But that's my perspective. I will say, however, that King Alexander has made some good moves, especially in clearing out some of the established bureaucracy there.
Well, you have a California connection with the King. I'm sure you've talked about your respective pasts in the Golden State.
That is indeed true. I saw King Alexander just the other day and mentioned to his surprise that I had done a tour of duty for a very short period of time out in Long Beach. I wasn't employed. I was there with a former spouse, let's say, but I did live in Long Beach for about 3 or 4 months. I know it well.
And you also grew up in San Diego.
That's right. It was a very different San Diego than it is nowadays. When I was in San Diego, it had fewer than 100,000 inhabitants. Most of them were retired chief warrant officers from the Navy, looking for the good life, driving a Rambler, and living happily ever after. I'll tell you, Jim, when I go back there now and look at the lay of the land, I see nothing that I recognize. Everything has been bulldozed and replaced. It's an uncanny experience.
You recall Lance Allworth?
Yes, I believe he played with the San Diego Chargers during my childhood, and John Hadle and Sid Gilman and a few other greats of the gridiron.
Gary Garrison?
He may have escaped my attention.
He was the other receiver, but Lance Allworth was the All-Pro and now Pro Football Hall of Famer. And interestingly, his ex-wife married Jim Guy Tucker, the former governor of Arkansas. A little bit of trivia there for Kevin Cope, a man who loves trivia.
Just shows you can move down by moving up.
Well, Jim Guy had some problems later and went to prison, but the marriage stayed intact. And I met your lovely bride from Germany. How did you meet?
Indeed, that's a wonderful story. As many years ago, we organized the conference here in Baton Rouge, and she came along with the entourage of her major professor. German professors often have a number of associate professors who travel and research with them. That is exactly what happened. We met really in earnest at the old Alligator Bayou at the conference concluding event that I also organized. Now, you're going to say, oh, you organized an academic conference in order to do a preliminary to Match.com or whatever. Wasn't my goal. It just happened that way.
So the sparks were flying at Alligator Bayou.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing how the wet can ignite the blazing.
With Kevin and Bear Bell, right?
Well, her name is actually Bearbel, but Bearbel, on the other hand, has a sort of French patois, and we know that Engster will eventually become Monsieur Engster at some point.
Well, I suspect she knows a few people who have my last name. I'm the only Engster in Louisiana, by the way.
Is that so?
That
well,
is true.
Amazingly enough, we were all together at a conference in Singapore about 2 weeks ago, and there one of her colleagues, a person who has your surname, her name is Engster as well, joined us to deliver some academic papers in that world center of Oriental capitalism.
What a small world. What is her first name?
Her name is Dorrit. Highly unusual name. To us, it sounds rather more like a root vegetable, but it's a common enough name in Germany.
Well, you teach English in addition to being head of the faculty Senate. How long now for is the president of the faculty senate?
I have been president of the faculty senate since 2007. I would suppose that's 7 years, going on my eighth now.
Eighth year, and you teach English.
That's correct.
What classes?
I teach the 18th century in English literature, the period of the American founding, the period of the great philosophers such as Locke, Descartes, Spinoza, etc. Mm-hmm. I teach the history of books and the book trade and bibliography. I, of course, teach many, many survey courses to the yearning masses who are seeking a general education, running from the earliest days, the medieval period, up to the end of my specialization, the 18th century.
Are these classes at Allen Hall?
Some of them are in Allen Hall. Unfortunately, there's a building that has a mixed future, either intense renovation or the bulldozer.
I hope not. No, they can't bulldoze Allen Hall, named after the former governor, O.K. Allen. In fact, Saturday, I was walking around campus, and I needed to use the facilities. And fortunately, Allen Hall was open, and I went in there. It's the first time I've been in there in a few years. And I remember the murals, which are still there. They were put up in the 30s, right?
Yes, those murals, I think, are major artistic monuments. You might be interested that, in a way, they span the state. There's another building in North Louisiana in Shreveport called the Louisiana State Exhibit Museum. The same artist did the same kind of futurist representation of Louisiana up there. So that is a link that connects the artistic legacy of the state.
Well, we're visiting with one of the most erudite men on the planet who calls Baton Rouge home, Kevin Cope, the professor of English and president of the Faculty Senate at Louisiana State University. And as I look at your website from the LSU English Department, it still says that your books include the forthcoming John Locke Revisited 1999. It doesn't look like this website's been updated in some time.
That is true. At this point, I have decided not to make an issue out of it because I regard that, so to speak, as an artifactual website. Queen Elizabeth has two birthdays, a private birthday and a public birthday. This is my public image because it suggests there's still hope. It doesn't show all the errors in the preceding 20 years.
Well, they have some great men and women at the Department of English, as they did when I was in school, taking classes at Allen Hall, but not so good on updating the website at your department.
I was going to say that we have a lot of shortfalls at LSU. That's one of them, but it's not the only one. For example, we need a little more help in facilities. On top of that, you mentioned Allen Hall, but the university is falling apart around the edges. So a shortfall here, a shortfall there, it's no surprise.
Well, Kevin Cope, a man, if you can hear, who is extremely articulate, who has written the likes of Spinning Descartes into Blake, Spirals, Vortices, and the Dynamics of Deviation. That sounds like some light reading for a weekend, but you know your school like few others and have taken quite a liking to the old war school. Why have you stayed 31 years?
You might say that it is the inevitability of a degree of imposed success. That is, I didn't really do much to ensure my success there. I simply plodded along, I suppose, like any other workaday fellow. And lo and behold, a day turned into a week turned into the month, and here I am. I think also, to be a little more serious, that people in Louisiana tend to underestimate what LSU is. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, it has many, many shortfalls, but it is at least in the top 200 or so of universities. That doesn't sound like a high ranking, but on the other hand, when you consider there are about 3,000 degree-granting institutions in the United States, you could do a lot worse. So the pyramid up from LSU is a lot narrower and a lot steeper than might seem.
297-5633, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and we shall take some inquiries for our learned guest. Here's one from Brij Mohan saying, the other day, Chancellor Alexander claimed that his administration is an open book. Does it apply to all rewards, including but not limited to merit and salary raises? If so, is the university going to announce all raises on the web for public scrutiny?
Oh, thank you, Brij. That is an excellent question. And I point out that an open book is something that's already been authored. Simply because a book is open doesn't mean that they were contributing authors. And I think that's what's at the root of the question. The other side of the question is, who is the audience for the book? An open book is not bought by everybody. So I do agree with you, Brij, that it is extremely unfortunate that the university is so, so very far behind in making documents public. It's not only the raises, it's all of the budgets, it's all of the matters that pertain to the operations of the athletic department. It's all of the details about plans for future building. The information is out there, but there is an extraordinary burden on the user to try to find it. For example, Dr. Mohan refers to the pay raises. In order to find those, you can't just go to the website and do a few clicks. You have to go over to the rare book library, penetrate security, prostrate yourself before the issue desk, and then you might be able to get it if the librarian, who's probably a student worker, can find it. This is not really accessibility. I am hopeful, and I have told the officials at the university that we should get all of that information online. So far, it hasn't been a priority. Maybe they don't have the time or the luxury to do that, but I sure hope that we can make that change soon.
297-5633 for Dr. Kevin Cope, president of the LSU Faculty Senate. Donald in Mid-City. Hi, Donald. You're on the air with Kevin Cope.
Hello, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and I hope you're enjoying this sunshiny day.
Of course, Dr. Cote. Last week in the Advocate in Baton Rouge, there was an article concerning the Faculty Senate at Southern University. I think it's the second time they've given the current president, Dr. Ronald Mason, a vote of no confidence. Seems to be a rather contentious relationship going over there so early in his tenure. I wonder what you think about that.
Thank you. This is a study in how matters can go wrong very quickly when the top-down governance does not proceed even with any kind of sensibility for public sentiment. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm going to take an unusual position and say that in some sense, all of the parties to that debate, the Faculty Senate, other faculty members who are not of a mind with the Faculty Senate, Ronald Mason, the system president, and former Chancellor Lorenz, they are, in a sense, all right, and they all are, in a sense, innocent. What has happened? Well, the faculty resent the system president, Ronald Mason, because he has imposed his own set of regulations on the campus. The campus, on the other hand, was out of control because the chancellor was imposed by a previous regime. The Faculty Senate is having trouble getting a grip on this because it does not have any handholds by which to exercise its power. It can only go to the press, which then stirs up bad feeling toward Southern University. If we had a good foundation for university governance, one that was not dependent on political appointments, that was not dependent on committees, situations like this wouldn't happen. We're also in the absence of prestige. It's similar to LSU. Nobody quite knows who's in charge at this moment.
297-5633, your number for the Erudite Kevin Cope, the professor of English at LSU for 31 years and president of the Faculty Senate for the past 7 years, back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757, inkstershow at wrkf.org. The Faculty Senate President of LSU for the last 7 years, Kevin Cope, is with us. And if you'd like to reach us online, inkstershow at wrkf.org. What about LSU becoming smoke-free on August 1st? Is this any big deal?
That is a good development. However, it's a good development, like many good developments, that is not without ambiguity. Certainly, everybody wants the campus to be a little bit healthier, and everyone wants to discourage students from doing deeds that, such as smoking, that are bad for them. At the same time, of course, we have two related problems. One is that we don't have any kind of program for those who are addicted to tobacco. There is a smoking cessation program at the campus, and the HRM department there has done a good job assembling that. However, the truth is that if everyone on the campus who smokes suddenly enrolled in the smoking cessation program, that the building where it's housed would probably collapse from the weight. So we've got to figure out how that will work. Another problem is, of course, that we have to have some accommodation in the university for individual rights and liberties. I'm a little bit concerned about policies that strike too much of a do-gooder note. And on the third hand, we've got the problem of enforcement. That is, I don't know who's going to go out there on football day with a periscope and nab that tailgater who's in trouble. On the other hand, of course, I think that everybody welcomes this. It's extremely unpleasant at certain buildings to walk in under a cordon of smoke. You may have heard that the library building had a kind of de facto smoker's area in front of it. You walk in to take out a book, and you would suddenly be hit with a blast that felt like you were walking into the fiery inferno.
Well, come August 1st, as in this Friday, LSU is smoke-free, and that includes tailgating. And it includes athletic events. And David Brown writes that it's been true for some time that the LSU baseball team is not allowed to use tobacco products. However, they do eat a lot of peanuts in the dugout, he writes. But believe me, they use tobacco products. And by virtue of their use, they will be in violation if they continue to do so when they're chewing tobacco during LSU baseball games.
You do raise an interesting problem there, and humorously, I will note, I remember a time when peanuts were regarded as dangerous, the aflatoxin scare of the 1980s. But even setting that aside, there are some other interesting features of this, and that is, of course, that university policy applies only to the university premises. Well, Skip Bertman Drive and also Nicholson Drive, that run more or less alongside the stadium, those are public terrains. The other day I was commenting to somebody that, of course, Highland Road in Dalrymple is public terrain, and it might be good indeed to see that the pillar of smoke was arising near where the churches are, because we all know that that's how Jehovah liked to do his business. I don't mean to say that this is trivial by any stretch of the imagination, and I stress again, it is a wonderful thing that now we are going to be free of smoke on campus, but with all such well-intentioned policies, there also needs to be some kind of follow-on.
297-5633 is your number for the incomparable Kevin Cope, president of the Faculty Senate. We're getting ready to dredge the LSU lakes. Is that a good thing?
Whether it's good or not, it probably has to be done, because if we don't do it, the lakes are going to turn into a sludge pit in the next few years. Maybe we can market them as the new La Brea tar pits. That having been said, I think there are a couple of questions to be raised. One is how the city and cahoots with the university arrived at the firm that will do the dredging. It's has not escaped anybody's notice that out of the competitive bids that went nationwide, there was a firm in Boston, for example, that bid, that we ended up choosing one that was at least sort of local, one in Alexandria and one in Houston, working cooperatively. I think also there's an element of kitsch in this, the notion that we're going to have the head of Mike the Tiger in the form of an island somewhere in the middle of the lake. This is kitsch in the highest caliber. Might be better to have the head of Old Gilligan from Gilligan's Island there.
Well, the lakes are a big part of the campus, and They have been since the WPA. That's how they started, right?
Yeah, that's true. And admittedly, they provide a lot of recreation. I think that they could be much more useful if we would hire some real design experts to consider the whole environment so that we had some usable parks. You think of that park, for example, that's on the jetty that leads across from Dalrymple Drive to the residential streets. Well, it's nice we've got a landing area there, but what kind of real recreation can you have in a park that's about 15 meters wide unless you're planning to practice the 50-yard dash all night? You're not going to get much fun out of that.
Well, we shall see how it plays out, but certainly we want LSU to be preserved as one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And it's amazing how many of the most prominent places, whether it be the lakes or where you are situated at Allen Hall, this was all done in the 1930s.
That's true. And I think if we look around America, we can see there have been a couple of great ages of expansion. One was the WPA area when so many interesting buildings were constructed. Another was the post-war period, say from the mid-50s up in the 1970s. It's really been about 40 years since we've had a phenomenal explosion of design and building. We were talking earlier about California. If you go out to California, it's as if you're living permanently in about 1972. That was the last time anyone could afford to build new and inventive buildings there.
And the governor at that time was Ronald Reagan.
Indeed.
You grew up with Reagan as your governor in
yes.
San Diego.
And that's right? Why I'm so squeaky clean. I was always washed in borax.
1966, Kevin Cope would have been 9 years old when the great communicator was elected governor of California and unseated Pat Brown.
Yeah. Nevertheless, I remember him. And that is because he had a certain charm and charisma that transcended his politics. Maybe I didn't agree with him, but you had to admit he had a good way of either turning a phrase or hiring people who could write phrases that he could turn well. Makes all of the difference. I think you're talking about King Alexander. One thing about King Alexander is that he has an extraordinary knack for articulating his message in a way that fits the audience. Other past presidents haven't had that, so I would say that that in itself can give you about a 10-20% edge in pushing your policies.
No doubt. Reagan, though, here's a guy who was a Hollywood actor, great communicator, nice-looking guy from the biggest state in America, and it took him three tries before he was elected president. And when he was elected, he was 69 years old. We've got our governor from Louisiana, who is 42 years old now, who wants to be president and will be running in a couple of years. Do you think he has some Reagan-esque qualities?
I think that he might be characterized as somebody who epitomizes a kind of counter-charisma. Now, I will give you, Jim, that will get you a certain distance. There are people who don't like charisma, maybe 10-20%. But let's face the fact, we have a governor who presents himself as an expert in everything. One day he knows all about execution drugs. The next day he knows about military service, which he never did, and hands out medals to veterans. The next day he builds sand berms along the shoreline. And yet we have yet to see any evidence that, like Ronald Reagan, he can even conjure the idea that he likes the people. This is a new phenomenon that is a local strongman who doesn't care about his local clientele. Think about Huey Long. Huey Long wanted to rise to power on the strength of the masses, the local masses. The situation we have here is the opposite. I would submit that that's a very dangerous situation in terms of alienation of the public.
Counter charisma, you call it.
Mm-hmm, yes. Well, if you listen to the typical speech from the governor's office, it is a compilation of facts and figures, statistics, policy wonk, factoids, that are designed to make the audience feel as if it is somehow less competent. The charismatic figure, on the other hand, somebody like Ronald Reagan, probably doesn't have any information at his hand at all, but nevertheless is able to engage the audience and make the audience feel like it's some part of a process, whether it is or not. When our present governor gets out on the national scene, as we saw from his famous answer speech after one of the State of the Union addresses, people will identify that, and there will not be any kind of upswelling.
Have you put on your big boy pants?
My big boy pants? I have to admit, I don't even know what they are.
He encouraged people to put on their big boy pants.
Well, I guess there's a perfect example. The advice didn't reach me. I don't have the slightest idea what he was talking about.
I doubt that if you were a speechwriter, you would have included that line to put on your big boy pants.
No. You know, I'm of the Peggy Noonan generation. I know how to turn a phrase at least so that somebody will pay attention.
Well, and of course, Bobby Jindal, as Foster Campbell noted, he is not a big boy, and he's talking tough. Politicians like to do that. You had Dianne Feinstein last week, or the senator from California, saying Putin needs to man up. What do you make of these politicians when they try to sound like they're Dick the Bruiser?
Yes. Well, I think that in that case, we need to have some kind of demonstration. First, we have to figure out what man up means. But once we get past that, if you take the hard definition, well, maybe we ought to see those folks in some kind of wrestling match. Or if it means something like start a war, perhaps we should see some policy that explains what's going to happen. Suppose that we man up against Vladimir Putin. What's the consequence of that? Maybe we should fire a missile or two? Well, I think that's not going to lead to any good consequence.
Well, he does take his shirt off a lot, and he is all of 5'6", so it would seem that somebody like Bobby Jindal, if he were to man up against Putin, he might have a fighting chance.
Oh, maybe so. If you've ever been to the old Eastern Bloc countries, you know the reason he takes off his shirt is that the cloth is of bad quality and feels bad and itchy.
297-5633 is your number, and a listener asks about your knowledge of a so-called fan survey that is in the works regarding the LSU football experience.
Yes, indeed. It indeed goes far beyond the football experience. There are also surveys relating to the baseball experience, and I wouldn't be surprised if there were one relating to the basketball experience. Unfortunately, or maybe it's fortunately, the actual attendance at sports matches across the SEC is going down, down, down.
Actual attendance.
The actual attendance, right. People physically in the stadium. Nobody knows for sure what the reason is. There are hypotheses ranging from the comfort of sitting on your sofa watching your 80-inch television and grabbing for the caramel corn to, on the other side, a moralistic objection to what you see and the fan behavior. Nevertheless, the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, is quietly, with very low profile, distributing a survey to apparently a select group of fans to ask about their perception of the game day experience. A lot of the issues that are touched there are interesting. They include fan behavior, i.e., do you not go to the games because you find the fans unpleasant? There's a lot of interest in the facilities. Actually, on the survey that I received, there are at least five questions relating to the restroom, so apparently that question of cleanliness that plagues Louisiana and elsewhere is much in the foreground. I think that this shows that collegiate sports, although they appear to be turning a lot of money, are past their peak moment. Think about the great dynasties of the past. Think about California, FedMart, one of the biggest chain stores, a predecessor of Walmart. Everybody thought that it would go on forever, but a moment came when it started to sink in class. That's exactly what's happening with athletics. As fans don't come, as they buy less, as they become just a little bit less interested, once you get past that peak, it's awfully hard to get back to it.
And the capacity goes to 102,321 for the Tigers. Is this year they entertain seven opponents, and those seven are Sam Houston State, New Mexico State, UL Monroe, Kentucky, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, and Alabama. It's a rather lackluster schedule for people paying top dollar to sit among the 102,320 of their closest friends.
That's true. If you've been in Tiger Stadium or Alex Box Stadium or the PMAC, you probably know that every game is, in theory, a sellout. But when you look around the stadium, you see not only a lot of empty spaces, but sometimes whole banks of empty spaces, even in the student section. This points up another question about athletics, is that although the stadium is expanding, so is the social inequity. Those new seats are for people who are paying really top dollar, and in effect they're renting them and then perhaps redistributing them to employees or whomever they want to favor. Well, That's all well and good for the university. It makes a lot of money, at least in the short term, but whether that can sustain the interest in on-site, real present athletics in the long term is for me another question.
There are many stories beyond the story involving LSU football, and it's true in other places as well. But at LSU, for example, you look out and 95% or more of the fans are white. And as you say, generally white people with means, and look down on the field and 80% of the team is black. And usually these kids come from backgrounds that are not stellar.
That's definitely true. And without attempting anything that would resemble prejudice, you could say that that is a very stark demonstration of the contrast. And when you get that level of contrast in any institution, where you've got one group of people who are at the bottom of the ladder, literally, they're down there on the field, and another people who are up top, well, you don't really have long, because football, basketball, baseball are expressions of social unity. People go there because they want to identify with the team. They want to identify with their town. They want to identify with their institution. When that identification breaks down, it's really only a matter of time.
Well, Ben in Mid-City, perhaps, who's heard us talk a time or two before, notes that perhaps the only sport remaining for the average guy is professional wrestling.
Yes. Of course, I've got two sports that are at the top of my list. One is horseshoe pitching, and the other is professional wrestling. And I suppose they go together because if you're a jarhead wrestler, maybe you don't have great taste in footwear. But I definitely agree with that. It's well known that I'm a fan of the classic age of wrestling. I watched professional wrestling from my very early years in the early 1960s up and through the 1980s. I still look in now and then. But I can say I've seen the greats. I've seen Freddie Blassie, Mil Mott. Oscaris, Luthez, Bull Ramos.
I forgot about Luthez.
Yeah, he was old. I've seen the best. And you know that squared circle has still got a lot of garbage in it. Used to be cleaned up. Freddie Blassie used to say that. Freddie Blassie was 60, 70, 80 years old. He said, "Why are you still wrestling?" And he'd say, "There's a lot of garbage in that squared circle that needs to be cleaned up."
Freddie Blassie is mentioned in Man on the Moon, the song from R.E.M. about Andy Kaufman.
Is he? His tune, Pencil Neck Geek, on tape.
Pencil Neck Geek, yeah. That's a term that perhaps should be used in political circles in some cases. Silas Bogue writes, "With the cost of two decent football tickets now out of budget for most Louisiana citizens and growing evidence of the brain damage associated with football, which will drive future players away from it, one can only wonder if the LSU stadium is not already overbuilt."
I agree completely. That's what I mean by we're past the peak moment. It doesn't seem like it. It seems that you can watch football 24 hours a day on one network or another. But the public criticism is getting more and more stiff, and the cost associated. Think about what happened to the NFL. Well, for the NFL, $750 million settlement, it's a drop in the bucket. But then look at Penn State after its episode with the child abuse in the football program. $60 million, that's a lot for a single institution, or it's even a lot for a league to endure. So I think we've really got to revise the whole business of athletics, including that question of injury. And when that revision happens, there's going to be a change in the cast of the games and a change in the cast of the fan base, if there is one. Yes, I do think it's overbuilt.
297-5633, Jim in Lafayette, you're on with Kevin Cope. Hi, Jim.
Yes, Dr. Cope, I'm curious about the profanity from the student section at the football games. I think that's discouragement to young families with young children coming to the games and hearing this these expletives from the student section. I think it's not in keeping with the old traditions of Tiger Stadium. Since you're a professor there at the university, can you do anything to help restrain these young men and women?
I think one thing that needs to be done is that we need to think about the operations of the Student Government Association at LSU and other campuses. To date, the student government associations around the nation, it's not just LSU, have been resistant to taking on ideas that are too hard. They want to concern themselves with student life. This is one area where they need to set a tone. Is it going to make any difference to say, don't say naughty words? No.
297-5633. A bit more time with Kevin Cope when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A bit more time with Kevin Cope, the LSU Faculty Senate President for the last 7 years, and celebrating 31 years at the Old War School. This man who is a man of degree, PhD from Harvard, master's from Harvard. Spent a lot of time in Cambridge, Massachusetts, didn't you?
I was there for 5 1/4 years. It was some of the best time of my life, but I also love Louisiana.
Jack on Florida. Jack, you're on the air with Kevin Cope. Hi, Jack.
Good morning, guys. How you doing today?
Fine.
Doing great.
Good, good. My question is, and basically something that affects everybody, and it seems like people are side-skirting and sidestepping, is the general cost of parking, buying a hot dog, getting two tickets, or four tickets if you got two kids, and going to a game. That is really, to me, the root cause of why people are not showing up. I just want to see, you know, how you feel about that.
In large measure, I agree with you. Cost is something that's a matter of perception. People will pay huge sums of money to wear an Armani suit, even though it's made out of $50 worth of cloth. So I think partly what you're saying, not to put words in your mouth, is that many fans don't think it's worth the money in order to have the experience that they receive. And maybe if it were a little bit more pleasant, they would be. On the other hand, I also agree with you that this is part of the alienation, as I call it. That is, that the fans don't feel part of the show, partly because the price is so high, it sends a message that this is only an amusement for the very upper class, what old Mitt Romney used to call the upper 53%, I guess.
Is that an Armani suit you have on?
It's not Armani, but all of my clothes are made in Germany.
Did your wife?
It's Armani Stein.
Chuck in Lafayette. Chuck, you're on the air with Kevin Cope. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning. I really enjoy your show every day. I particularly enjoy it when Dr. Cope is on because I like his wit and insight.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. My question is, given the peaks and valleys of the last 6 or 7 years since Bobby Jindal's been in office, have we seen the valley for higher education in terms of faculty and being able to get some raises? Are we on our way up, or do we have to keep waiting until we get a new governor?
That's a good comparison to Valley. If you've ever been in Death Valley, you know that when you get to the bottom of the valley, there is, in a sense, an even deeper valley. The ground is cracked from being dry so long since there was water there in prehistoric times. So you can go even deeper. I would submit that we're now out of the crack. We're on top of the dry bed. We're looking up and we're taking the first steps up those little mud formations that have survived there. I don't think that we're really going to have to wait for a new governor because the total mass of university leadership, although I often criticize it, is a whole lot better than it was a few years ago, and a whole lot more ready to believe that the governor's time here is now passing. He's only got whatever it is, a year and a third to go. So I think some people are looking to the future, and also don't miss the fact that whatever its pluses and minuses, the university leadership that is here now is mostly from the outside and mostly accustomed to a different way of doing business. We're creeping up the ladder. Haven't got very far, but I do think the worst of it is over.
What do you think of the privatization that's occurred under this administration?
I think it's the biggest pile of nonsense since Margaret Thatcher decided to go after the Falkland Islands. That is, the notion of privatization is that responsibility for public deeds can be turned over to the public. That is false empirically. There is not enough money in the state to produce year in and year out the $1.5 billion that it takes to run 34 university campuses. Also, it's a serious psychological, emotional, and political problem in that when you turn something private, people in the public sphere start to feel that they're not responsible for it. It's the same thing you see in the public schools. Everybody's happy that we have the opportunity here to go to some very fine parochial and private schools, but the result is that the public schools are abandoned. That's what happens under privatization. But most emphatically, I say that it is just not consistent with the numbers. There is not enough private charity money in this state or the surrounding 10 states to operate these systems. We need to have a real tax base that is really going to support our institutions.
What do you think of these self-hating public servants, people like our governor who have worked their entire lives in the public sector, and they have this great love for the private sector where they have never toiled?
I think that that is indeed summed up in one word, and that word is hypocrisy. So, yes, this point is well taken. That is, the more we hear people beat a drum, the less likely they are to be part of the goat skin across the drum. So, for example, in the various boards of supervisors, not only LSU, but University of Louisiana, we keep hearing about workforce development, accomplishment, self-determination, prosperity through hard toil. Every last one of them has inherited their money.
Mm-hmm. Got a question here about the tolerance resolution, tolerance ordinance last week that was a no vote from the Metro Council, which will revisit the issue on August 13th. Does that in any way affect recruiting for LSU?
It certainly does, because people on the outside don't even know the terms of this debate. Now, I will say that although I'm in favor of this ordinance, and although I believe that we are showing our backwardness yet again by not approving something that's so easy to approve as a message to the world that we like most everybody, nevertheless, of course, it does have a little bit of the symbolic and good do-gooding feel about it. On the other hand, of course, people on the outside simply look at Louisiana and say, well, this is a place that's xenophobic, that hates this group or that group, and that indeed deters the out-of-state students whom we are so eager in pursuit of. It deters industry. Why do you think, for example, that when we were going after Hawker Beechcraft, people didn't show up? It wasn't because Hawker Beechcraft didn't get a good deal here. It was because they thought that the place was too slow culturally for the needs of their high-tech, high-workforce-developed people.
All right. Another question from a listener. Jeff wants to know if you actually go to the LSU football games.
I have been several dozen times in the course of my career here. I will admit I'm on the take. I've been privileged many times. I've sat in the royal box with the presidents and the chancellors and the philanthropists or whatever. I do not go every time by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I didn't go last season at all. I don't have an aversion to sports. I like sports. I have to do something other than deal with the troubles of academe. On the other hand, I think, of course, that the fact that I'm going less often than I used to is just an indication of how much of an effort it is. It's an 8 to 9 hour day at a minimum just to go there, see it, and come back.
You like Les Miles?
Well, I think that Les Miles needs to set a higher standard, a higher bar in terms of commitment to academics. It's as though he's living in some sort of other world, an outer moon of the great institution. And I do think that we need to have somebody who can make articulate statements to the media. Think about Jack Armstrong, the American boy who used to quote Shakespeare after receiving a touchdown pass. When was the last time that Les Miles turned to the Bard of Avon for inspiration?
I don't hear Saban quoting Shakespeare that often either.
No, but I suspect that Saban, in the back of his mind, knows certain things about Shakespeare, such as Richard III reached too far and fell.
Okay. Well, an LSU football coach who is winning, as Coach Miles has, becomes quite possibly the most powerful person in the state. Should Les Miles have used that capital to go down to the Capitol and protest these budget cuts that have afflicted higher education?
The answer is yes, and that's what I mean by the outer orbit phenomenon. I don't know where the football department has been in this, but of course it would have been easy to take down an ensemble of coaches and players and simply make a statement. Let's face the facts. It didn't happen. I don't know what's in his heart. Maybe God loves Les Miles and is preparing a high place for him, but I'm looking at the facts, and it didn't happen.
Well, we thank you for joining us today. The man who never holds back, the head of the Faculty Senate. How do you keep your job as head of the Faculty Senate?
Maybe it's a combination of sheer moxie and making a fool of myself so much that nobody else wants to do it.
That's true. Maybe no one else wants the job. But thank you, Kevin Cope, and we look forward to visiting with you during your 32nd year at the Old War School.
And thank you, Jim.
And joining us in studio now is Katie Full, who is the new curator for the LSU Museum of Art. Good morning to you.
Morning. Thank you so much for having me.
And you've been here how long, Katie?
I have been here about 2 months.
2 months.
Yes.
And from where did you come?
I just finished a PhD from Harvard as well, actually.
Well, you and Kevin Cope, Kevin and Katie.
And I'm moving
down
here.
A lot of brain power in the studio right
now. Most directly from Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
The fighting city of brotherly love, home of the Phillies, who are 12 games under 500 right now. But you've come from some interesting places. What compelled you to come this way?
You know, I really believe Louisiana is a really fascinating opportunity. You know, I mean, I work mostly on American art, and it's a part of the world and a part of the country that really hasn't received the attention it deserves in terms of the talent and vibrancy of the culture.
Katie Full. It's P F O H L.
German, silent P.
Yes, yes. Full.
And in fact, my email address is simply katie@lsu.edu entirely because of the complication of my last name.
Are you the only Katie at LSU? I don't know. But at any rate, you have an interesting name. I've seen it before. But it is Full, not Puffle. It's Full. From Katie, who is the new curator for the LSU Museum of Art. Tell us about the museum. This is one of the hidden jewels on campus and off campus, and you have some great great work that is exhibited frequently, including very soon.
Yes. So, you know, the museum is really a remarkable place. It has a world-class art collection of over 5,000 objects, and it ranges from everything from a world-class collection of Chinese jade to incredible collections of work by Louisiana artists like African-American artist Clementine Hunter to LSU faculty and School of Art faculty who have some terrific works in the collection as well. And so, you know, one of the big things that I'm going to be doing as curator now is completely reinstalling the permanent collection so that we can really bring some of these totally incredible works of art out into public view for really the first time in decades.
And coming soon, you'll have a display of the fabulous sports artist Leroy Neiman.
We will. So opening on August 1st with a party on July 31st is an exhibition about Leroy Neiman, who is really one of the most important artists of sports of the 20th century.
Probably the most important.
Yes. He really presided over defining moments in American athletics and witnessed the transformation of sports from this kind of homespun entertainment to nationwide spectacle. So Neiman was really at the sidelines of important Super Bowls, World Series events, prize fights, and really drew literally on the sidelines almost all of the famous iconic artists of American sports. And so we have many of those works, as well as works of that Neiman did of LSU athletes like Pete Maravich and others.
Well, he's synonymous with Muhammad Ali. Joe Namath did a lot of Joe Namath's. And he did some remarkable work, and he's one of those signature artists. When you see something, you know it's from Leroy Neiman. And it's August 1st, the opening. And where will the folks be assembling to see the works from the great Leroy Neiman?
At the Shaw Center downtown, 100 Lafayette Street, and the museum is on the fifth floor. So we are open Monday through Friday and then on the weekends as well. And July 31st from 6:45 to 8:45, we're having a terrific opening party. We'll feature a lot of LSU athletic greats and all kinds of really fun food and drink inspired by the history of sports.
That's this Thursday.
It's this 6:45, Thursday, 6:45
to 8:45. Shaw Center, the LSU Museum of Art, and fifth floor of the Shaw Center, and you'll see works from Leroy Neiman. I saw a display or an exhibit of his in Louisville a few years ago.
Oh, great.
And of course, there was a lot of Muhammad Ali down the street from the Ali Center, but the most expensive works, as far as people who were buying his artistry, were from Arnold Palmer, the golfer. There was a great market for Arnold Palmer's. Will people be able to purchase his works?
We do have a number of limited edition posters as well as a really amazing serigraph of Shaquille O'Neal for sale in our museum store.
So you got Pistol Pete, Shaquille O'Neal.
Pistol Pete, Shaquille O'Neal, Muhammad Ali, Joe Namath, all of the greats. He really worked for athletic teams and from the college level up through national sports events. He was the artist in residence for several Olympics. And so he really painted and drew many of the most iconic American athletes.
And he lived a long life.
And he lived a very long life.
Do you recall him in his prime, or are you too young for that?
Well, I have to tell you that one of the coolest things about working on this exhibition has been the fact that, for once, every time I say the name of the artist that we're featuring in the museum, everyone knows who he is.
Yeah. You grew up in Philadelphia, right?
I actually grew up all over the place. I was born in upstate New York, and I moved 12 or 13 times all over the country. Never this far south, so this is a new experience.
But you were in Philadelphia. I imagine there's some Dr. J's and some Mike Schmidt's that were done by Leroy Neiman as well. So he is a fabulous artist. How many works will be on display?
So we have over 80 of his works, and everything from the iconic posters that were on the covers of Sports Illustrated magazines and Wheaties boxes that everyone knows and loves, to about 60 or 70 of his drawings that were done directly on the sidelines of big sporting events that haven't been seen in decades. So it's a really fun chance to really see Neiman as an artist who really was immersed with the players and working right on the sidelines, capturing bodies in motion and some of the coolest moments in the history of sports.
I'm looking at the Pete Maravich one right now, and it is Pete in his LSU uniform, number 23.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't worn that number in 44 years, and of course, Pete's been gone now for 26 years, but he scored more points than anybody in the history of the game in college basketball and major college basketball, and his legacy lives on. Unfortunately, not in the LSU Hall of Fame, but you can see Pistol Pete in all his glory through the beautiful work of Leroy Neiman. Also some Joe Montana here, I see. So the San Francisco 49ers quarterback will be featured prominently. Any particular sport more than others that he catered to?
He really drew across the board and was really just interested in everything from gymnasts and dancers to football players. We're going to be focusing a little bit on his work in football. We actually have incredible sketches of football players that he did blown up to 16 feet high in the galleries, and really as an effort to showcase what an amazing artist he was. So there's going to be a bit of a football emphasis as well as a real LSU emphasis, because he was really fascinated by LSU sports. And so we're going to have wonderful antique lockers signed by all the LSU greats, footballs, baseballs, all kinds of stuff.
Katie Full, the new curator for the LSU Museum of Art. 6:45 this Thursday, the exhibit runs through
February 15th.
So it'll be there for a while.
For a while.
Beautiful. And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.